Registration is now open for the 2018 Apologetics Canada Conference. The conference is located in beautiful Abbotsford, British Columbia on March 2nd and 3rd. We have another amazing lineup of speakers. Get all the details and register at apologeticscanadaconference.com.
Hey everybody, welcome to the AC Podcast. This is Steve Kim.
Andy Steiger.
Terry Crosby.
We have somebody very special on the line today. I mean, we've had on our show theologians, apologists, philosophers, and things like that, but it's not every day that we actually get to have a forensic pathologist on the line. We have on the line with us today, all the way from New Hampshire, Dr. Tom Andrew. He was, up until recently, correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Andrew, but you were New Hampshire's chief medical examiner until recently.
That's correct.
And you're board certified in pediatrics, anatomic pathology, forensic pathology, a member of the National Association of Medical Examiners, American Academy of Pediatrics, so on and so forth. Dr. Andrew's CV is, I looked at it, it's 10 pages long. So if you want to, this should give you a sense of the kind of person that he is. He's a very accomplished person. We recently found out about Dr. Andrew from a New York Times article that kind of featured his story, written on October 7th of this year. With all of that said, thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Andrew.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I got to tell you, Dr. Andrew, this is Andy, and I think you said we could call you Tom. Tom, I got to tell you.
Yeah, that works.
I am so glad to have you on the show. It has been a long time I've waited to have a corner on the line. I've got a lot of questions for you. This is exciting for me.
He's been pretty giddy for about two weeks now.
Well, I'm certainly not nearly as exciting as apologists and theologians, but I'll see what I can do to fill the gap.
Yeah, we'll see about that. I have a feeling you are. The first thing that I'd like to ask you, and this is a question that we've received from people as they heard that we were going to have you on the line, and that is, I'd love to know, just how did you get into this field? I mean, did you watch a whole bunch of CSI and thought, okay, that's the career I'm going into?
Well, interestingly enough, I'm too old to have been swept in on the wave of CSI. The show that I watched when I was a kid was called Quincy. Although that's not what swept me into this either. Really, the beginnings of it was a series of lectures during my second year of medical school during the pathology course that was given by the forensic pathologists who worked in Cincinnati. I thought it was really fascinating. But I was very, very laser beam focused on a career in pediatrics at that point. So It was interesting, but if you know what I mean. Then I made the mistake, if you will, in my senior year by spending a month of elective time with the coroner's office in Hamilton County, which is Cincinnati, and really became enamored with it. But once again, very focused on pediatrics. I matched in pediatrics. I went ahead and did my residency and pursued private practice in pediatrics. But that forensic call was always back there. I soon found out that the cases that really engaged me as a pediatrician were the ones that interfaced with forensic medicine. Things like child abuse and neglect, sudden unexpected infant death, consumer product safety issues. Those kinds of things are natural partners, if you will, with forensic medicine. So it was a very natural thing or feeling thing for me, even though it looks kind of strange from the outside.
What is it like, you know, day in and day out dealing with dead bodies?
Well, obviously, it is something that a young person, when you're embarking on your career, find out very, very early in the game. If it's something that you can do for 20, 30, 40 years, once you become acclimated to just the macabre nature of what you're doing, and you can really focus on, one, the science and the medicine involved, and two, collating that information in such a way that that person then speaks to their loved one with the answers that that loved one is desperately looking for. And that's usually something as simple as the cause of death. But sometimes it's, why didn't this therapy work, or why were they not able to be rescued or saved? And that's who you're really working for. You're really working for that phone call that you will be making at the end of the examination. So that's how I think you deal with it. You're just another physician in another specialty imparting information that someone can use. And I think you quickly get over the dead body aspect of it.
I was reading online, and there was one quote that that I came across, and you says, "I don't think you can effectively minister to the families who are left behind when you make the phone call after the autopsy." Did you feel at that point in time somewhat of a minister in working with and giving that information to the family afterwards?
There's no question I did not use that word randomly. Yeah. I do see it as such. And that's a very, very important part of our work. There was an article written by one of our, you know, pioneers in the field, a doctor named Lester Adelson, who wrote an article way back, I believe in 1960, called Forensic Pathologist, Family Physician to the Bereaved. That's a charge that we need to take very, very seriously, because so many other healthcare providers are at a loss at what to say or to do at a time of sudden, unexpected, or particularly violent death, and they don't feel equipped to help the families through this, and that's specifically what we're trained for.
Mm. You know, over the years that you've done this, what are some of the greatest challenges to your work?
You know, the challenges have very little to do with the work itself. I think either you have the foundations to deal with the mental and emotional aspects, or you don't. And if you don't, you find something else to do. The real difficult challenges over the years have come simply because this is, in almost universally, wherever you work, a public sector job that is chronically under-resourced and underfunded and understaffed. So there's always this sense of being on a treadmill and working from behind. Now, that's not necessarily a complaint. I think young people who go into this field go into it largely eyes wide open, knowing that that's the situation. But when you that feeling of never being able to catch up, I think, has been the biggest challenge over the years to me.
When we read your article, or the New York Times article featuring your story, we really resonated with what you're going through there in New Hampshire with the opioid crisis, because we in British Columbia were facing much the same thing. In fact, just last week in our town in Abbotsford in British Columbia, five people died from drug overdose involving fentanyl.
Within 10 hours.
And I have friends who are working as paramedics and things like that, and they are having a really hard time coping with all of that. It sounds like that much the same thing is happening in New Hampshire, and that has really put some significant strain on your work environment.
That's exactly right. It has really totally, totally changed the pace of our entire practice. When I first started here in 1997, this state saw 30 to 40 drug deaths a year. Well, as we went through the late 90s into the 2000s and entered into the prescription opiate disaster, we sort of passed 100, then 200 drug deaths. But heroin made its comeback, as you know, in like 2010, 2011. And at the end of 2013, that's when the fentanyl and fentanyl analogs hit the street, and our deaths ratcheted up exponentially after that. The last couple of years, we've seen upwards to 500 drug deaths a year.
Wow.
Now, if it were any other kind of death, you know, if you saw a 1,000% increase in any other kind of death, breast cancer, asthma, traffic crashes, domestic violence, I mean, people would be really jazzed about it. Well, finally, they're jazzed about this, but it took much longer than it needed to.
Well, it's interesting. This year in British Columbia, we're on track to having 1,400 overdoses by January.
That's tragic.
Yeah, it's just tragic. And I completely agree with you. I mean, this has taken way too long for people to take notice. Mm. There's a question that I've been wondering, I've been hearing in the news, and that is that this opioid crisis is so bad that morgues cannot keep up, and that many times bodies are being refrigerated out in the parking lot in trucks and whatnot. I mean, is that true? Have you experienced that?
We have fortunately not had to go that route. We came fairly close and actually began initiating discussions with a firm to provide that service for us. We ultimately did not need it. that is not to say that it hasn't happened in other jurisdictions. And I'm thinking of several in Ohio in specific. I don't know why Ohio is so hard hit. I don't know why we're so hard hit. But I know that they have utilized refrigerated trucks outside of their facilities to deal with the overflow.
Has it been hard for you guys to keep up? I did read in the New York Times article that you actually can only do so many examinations. There's actually a limit, and I believe it's 250 a year.
That's right. Our accrediting organization, which is the National Association of Medical Examiners, has by way of an inspection standard that no individual forensic pathologist should exceed 250 autopsies per year. That can give you a deficiency. If an individual pathologist exceeds 325 per year, then you lose your accreditation entirely. So it would be the difference between a provisional accreditation, which needs to be fixed, or you'll lose it, or just losing it outright.
I'm guessing they do that for your benefit.
It's not just our benefit, although there is a benefit to us. But don't forget, if you are doing 400, 500 cases a year, which happens in some jurisdictions, you begin to cut corners. You are fatigued. You cannot give the work the attention that it needs. And this is very important work. And that's why that standard exists. But we had to decide, by we, I mean we here in New Hampshire, which standard we were going to run afoul of. Because either you do 250 autopsies apiece, or you are in compliance with the other standard, which says that all known or suspected drug overdoses shall be autopsied. Well, the numbers obviously don't add up. If we had 500 drug deaths and each pathologist did 250 of them, how would the homicides get done? How would the traffic fatalities get done? How would the suicides get done? How would the other accidents get done? How would the 60% of other forensic medical work that is natural death, natural deaths comprise 60% of our casework, how would those get done? So we had to decide, and we chose the 250 autopsy per pathologist standard, and we developed a triage system wherein we had to select which drug overdoses we would actually bring in for autopsy and which we would do an external examination and toxicology testing only on. It was a difficult choice to make.
Are there any discussions taking place in different jurisdictions to accommodate for that, knowing that there is this opioid crisis happening and the morgues are just overflowing?
Well, the short answer is yes. The longer answer is, where have they been? I've just recently returned from the National Association of Medical Examiners meeting in Scottsdale, Arizona, and there are a tremendous number of new positions that are open now for forensic pathologists. Legislatures and county governments have finally realized what dire straits we're in and have authorized these new lines in the budget. The problem is there are not enough people to fill them. At any given time, there are only about, and I'm talking about the United States here, there are only 400 full-time practitioners of forensic pathology in all of the country. We need 1,000 people yesterday, and yet we only have 400 people working full-time. Our average age is around 55.
Wow. So in other words, this is going to get even worse quickly.
Yes, it will. How many young people, would you imagine, sat for the American Board of Pathology certifying examination for forensic pathology this year? Well, the answer is 27.
Wow.
We cannot replace ourselves. We cannot replace ourselves, and I don't know what direction this is going to go, at least in the short term while we're dealing with this opiate situation.
Well, one of the things our listeners might find interesting is, and we'll post this on the show notes, is an article that was released by The Economist speaking to this opioid crisis, particularly with regards to fentanyl and why all of a sudden this has hit the streets with such gusto. But one of the things that The Economist was bringing out is just the economics of this drug. 1 kilogram of fentanyl costs around $4,000 to buy from China and yields profits of $1.6 million on the streets. Whereas by contrast, 1 kilogram of heroin costs around $6,000, but is worth only a few hundred thousand dollars, if that. I've seen other figures that say only about $80,000. Now, it seems to me that what the problem is then is with regards to fentanyl, it's incredibly potent, so you only need a little bit of it, which makes it easier to smuggle in, but it needs to be cut so that it can be used. But the problem then becomes, how do you cut carfentanil, which is 10,000 times more powerful than heroin? How do you cut that without killing your user?
There is not much concern about killing the end user. These samples have astonishingly high percentage of purity. Gone are the days when you would buy street heroin, and if it got seized and analyzed, it would be anywhere from 25 to 40% pure. When the heroin made its comeback in the mid-2000s, street samples were approaching 98% purity. The fentanyl samples are not diluted out very much either. They don't particularly care about killing the end user, and that is a tremendously tragic indictment of the insatiable appetite that we have here north of the border for that smuggled in contraband.
Mm. Well, so you're saying
let them die. There's always somebody in the queue to buy it from me.
Wow. So what you're seeing with regards to these overdoses is that the level of fentanyl that's in their blood is quite potent, is quite pure.
The autopsy, all we can do is document the presence of the agent that killed them. The purity aspect of it has to be done by the crime laboratory on analyzing seized material in the glassine packets. Uh-huh. So they are the ones that do the analysis of the purity. And I'm taking it by word of mouth that these preparations are highly pure.
I wanted to ask you just a really practical question that I know people have asked and would love to know. When you are examining these bodies, how do you determine, you know, that this is a drug overdose? And in particular, what do things like fentanyl do to the body? Why are they dying because of fentanyl?
Well, like any medical problem, everything begins with, and to a large extent, rests on the history. And that's even before you examine the patient. So, you know, there may be a known history of drug use or drug misuse. Someone may have actually seen the individual injecting or snorting or what have you. There may be the accoutrements of drug abuse at the scene of death, provided it hasn't been cleaned up by the associates. A syringe, a tourniquet, packets of powder. So those are your first clues that you're likely dealing with something like this. Mm. And then at the autopsy, there are corroborative findings. They aren't diagnostic because different things can cause these findings, but you see things like very heavy fluid-filled lungs, a swollen brain, a very distended bladder. They may have enlarged lymph nodes in particular areas of the abdomen that suggest intravenous drug use. But the proof of the pudding, the diagnostic test, is obviously what's in their blood at the time of their death. And it almost is variably, at least 80% of the time here, is going to be an opiate, and 90% of those 80% is going to be fentanyl or one of its analogs.
I heard that up to around 50% of those that die of fentanyl have signs of cocaine as well in their blood. Is that something you've encountered?
I think that varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Ours is probably closer to 30-35%, but they're all in that same range. Cocaine has always been a fellow traveler of opiates. The famous speedball, for example, that killed John Belushi, the comic. So that kind of thing has been around for a long time. But they kill in different ways. Opiates generally cause death by respiratory depression. You just slow down your breathing to the extent that you're no longer getting oxygen to your heart and to your brain.
So you suffocate together.
You die and there is no sense of air hunger. It's not a painful or a panicky way to die. You are essentially, sleep's actually very gentle, all things considered. Mm. Cocaine is a different story. It's a powerful stimulant, so it may induce heart rhythm disturbances or stroke or excited delirium. It's a very different drug, and its fatal effects are quite different.
What about carfentanil? Is that something you've been encountering? And what's the difference between it and fentanyl?
Fentanyl is the parent drug from which all of these analogs are being developed by these illicit chemists. And carfentanil is indeed a pharmaceutical agent that was commercially available, but it's commercially available on the veterinary market. It is roughly 10,000 times more potent than morphine, which is the gold standard. Pharmaceutical fentanyl is about 20 to 30 times more potent than morphine, but carfentanil is upwards to 10,000 times that. It was a drug that was formulated and designed to anesthetize or assist in the induction of anesthesia of large animals for veterinary practice. And I mean large, not just a big dog. I'm talking about elephants and things of that nature.
Does it kill in the same way as fentanyl?
Well, it does, but so much more quickly. I mean, if fentanyl is X and carfentanil is X number of thousand times X, it is the potency of the drug that kills, and it kills rapidly. And the other thing about its potency is that's what's working against the first responders who are administering naloxone in an effort to revive the person. If they encounter a person who has overdosed on heroin, 2 or 4 milligrams of naloxone might revive them. If it's fentanyl, it may take 6 or 8. With carfentanil, they may use upwards to 10 or 12 and still not be able to revive the individual.
Wow. This sounds like such a difficult job to do day in, day out. You've said if you don't allow yourself to be moved, if you detach all your humanity, you better get out. How did you balance?
You
balance the life of a forensic pathologist?
Well, I suppose one could do it with drugs or alcohol or other sorts of inappropriate diversions. But that's where your own personal network of support and your faith system comes into play. How could you not rely on either a community of faith or your own faith or the love and the faith of your family to get through this? I don't know how others do, you know, save for the drug and the alcohol crowd, but this work can take a toll on people in that regard as well.
Yeah. Tell us about your faith experience, Tom.
I don't know that experience even describes it. It's more of an evolution, at least in terms of my case. Mm. I mean, I don't have that blinding flash of penetrating insight story, you know, where I sat bolt upright and I knew that Jesus was the Lord of my life and the Son of the Creator of the universe. It was baked into the cake, if you will. I mean, I was raised in a family of faith. We attended a Presbyterian church in my youth. I was a youth member of the Boy Scouts, and our charter organization was a Methodist church. And both pastors, my home church pastor, as well as the pastor of the Methodist church where I was a scout, were very influential in my faith walk for different reasons and in different ways. The Presbyterian pastor was this kind of dour, towering Calvinist guy, and I don't mean that in any disrespectful way at all, because he, in his own way, was kind of warm and nurturing, but he's the one who taught my confirmation classes. He led me through the decisions that one is capable of making at 13 or so. But the pastor at the Methodist church was this young, hip guy. You're drawn to him as a youth, and he taught me my God and Country Award, which was a scouting award at the time, and gave me my first opportunity at ministry. He saw something and he said, I want you to deliver the message on Scout Sunday. So here's this 14-year-old know-nothing in the pulpit of this Methodist church delivering a sermon.
Wow.
And that may well have been the very beginnings of a call that's always been with me. Mm-hmm. And my father, my earthly father, always thought I would be in the ministry, but I was a science geek. You know, I knew I was going to go into medicine despite my dad thinking I was going to go into the ministry. But now I have.
But now there's something quite profound, though, in spiritual, just I'm guessing, in dealing with dead bodies. And I'm wondering how that has either challenged or informed your faith.
It has not challenged it at all. As a matter of fact, there are far more believers, I mean very, very committed believers, in forensic pathology than you might imagine. And I think it is precisely because of the things, and not despite of the things we see. It is because we see them. I think a true hard look at our mortality should be a catalyst to living a purpose-filled life and having some foundation, having some knowledge that there is something far, far bigger than you out there. And I think that's what these examinations, you know, somewhere between 5,900 of them over the years have done for me.
Wow. You've done 5,900 examinations over your career.
Roughly, yeah, give or take, sure.
Now, I'm going to guess that people don't need to convince you, or they'd have a hard time arguing you out of the idea that people are broken and that evil is real.
No argument from me there, and I agree with you. No one could take me off of that argument as well. No, the fluff about all of us being basically good is just that. It's fluff. Evil does indeed exist, and it exists to some extent in each and every one of our hearts, and that has to be extinguished by the work of the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm. Amen. Has that been tough over the years, just seeing the real heart of human darkness as you have examined these bodies?
Tough in the sense of grieving for the human condition, yes. Mm-hmm. That's very hard. Not all of these individuals have ended up where they are by specific choices that they made. And the more difficult ones are, at least for me, is how did God let this happen to this child? Where was God when this child was taken, or when this innocent person was taken by this tragic circumstance? But, you know, those aren't questions that I can answer. And if I tried to come up with some sort of answer, obviously, I would be perhaps pushed in another direction. But I do think that over the course of time, it has all combined to push me closer to God rather than away from Him.
So after your 20 years of in the forensic life, it sounds like you started asking the bigger questions to yourself, just about, you know, how you can help in a better way. So now you've gone on to seminary. You've started that path already.
Well, I have not started it in the classroom yet. And just for extra credit, you know, I had the 10 years in New York before I came here, so it's really 30.
Oh wow! Okay.
In the field.
Yeah.
So my seminary experience actually begins in January at the United Theological Seminary in Dayton, Ohio.
Okay.
I will begin there in January with an intensive course on campus. I will do about 2/3 of my work via distance learning online, but we'll be on campus for an intensive course 1 week each semester. So I'm really looking forward to the opportunity to dig in. I do have some trepidation about being a student again after being on the front side of the classroom for 30 years. Want to be a little cautious about any kind of swag you might bring into a classroom because you just happen to be an old guy. You know, they have to watch that. The swag will disappear as soon as they place that first lesson in Greek and Hebrew in front of me.
So I'm just curious, as you go into seminary, what is it that you hope to accomplish through all of that? I mean, from the New York Times article, it sounded like the reason you went to seminary, you chose to go to seminary, is to somehow help in this opioid epidemic or any sort of this spiritual struggle that lies underneath it. Is that an accurate description?
It's not inaccurate, but it's not precise either. The call to ministry has always been to youth ministry in general, but ministry within the infrastructure of the Boy Scouts of America in specific. I was a youth scouter. I have been involved in scouting as an adult volunteer for many, many years. I'm totally sold out on the values that that particular youth serving organization can give to its members. And now girls, if you've been following the news about the Boy Scouts here. So we're going to start admitting girls as well. So I'm not looking to plow new ground in youth ministry. I want to plug into an existing system within the Boy Scouts as a chaplain, which obviously has a much more interfaith focus than a sectarian focus, which, you know, I don't have a problem with. I'm happy to work in that framework. And I am now. I'm currently the chair of the Daniel Webster Council's Religious Relations or Duty to God Committee. And by Daniel Webster Council, I mean basically all of the Boy Scout units in the state of New Hampshire. There are 8 districts that comprise the council. So that's where my ministry will be focused. Now, how did the opiates work its way into this? Well, it worked its way into it as yet one of many symptoms of our soul-sick society. And what I aim to try to do as a chaplain within the Scouts is help that organization build a foundation in these young people such that they can make a better moral and ethical choice when they're faced with that decision. And they're going to be faced with it. And they're not going to be faced with it in high school or college. It's going to be middle school when someone comes up to them with the pill or the joint or the packet of powder. And without any foundation whatsoever, don't forget, 80% of people here in northern New England are unchurched. But in the Boy Scouts, there is a strong duty to God component. Now, I don't mean to oversimplify. I realize that, you know, this is not a just say no sort of moment. There are many, many pathways to substance abuse. I simply want to work at this end of it to provide that foundation so that they are able to say no, and others will have to deal with addiction that may spring from the misuse of prescribed opiates. I mean, one person can't do everything. Yeah. Everybody has their little piece, and this is the piece that I've chosen for myself.
And you know, something, Tom, that I think is so important about that. Well, by the way, I was a Boy Scout as well, so I appreciate what you're saying. The community and mentorship is absolutely essential with regards to this issue. Over 84% of people that OD do so alone. And there are different books out there, such as Chasing the Scream, that have really raised this issue that loneliness and depression can often be right at the heart of this opioid addiction.
You couldn't be more correct. And as you said, it's been beautifully documented in Chasing the Scream. That emptiness, I think, has something that can fill it. And that's the angle that I'm working from here. But you're right. So many of these people are so desperate, so lonely, that the only escape they have from this incredible emotional turmoil is that period of time when they are in that, you know, euphoric or unconscious state that this drug affords them. And that's obviously a sad commentary on what we've let our society become in this sort of very disconnected, yet it's ironic. It is an oxymoron that we are so connected, in quotation marks, in terms of electronics and the cyber world, yet so disconnected on a one-to-one level. It's extremely sad. And that's part of the beauty of something like scouting, where teamwork and depending on others and being unplugged in the great outdoors is such a strong feature of the program.
This has been just absolutely fascinating. We would love to continue our conversation, but we're out of time here. Thank you again so much for taking some time out of your busy schedule to speak to us on this issue. This has been very enlightening. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, and thanks for having me.
We pray God's blessing on you in this next season that God has you in as you continue to do ministry.
I do so appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you, listeners, for joining us. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll come back next week with more stuff to think about. Not sure if we can top this one, because when do we ever get to speak with an accomplished forensic pathologist? But we'll do our best. We'll see you next week. If you enjoy and appreciate the AC podcast, show us some love on iTunes. Please consider leaving a review. It helps us keep doing what we're doing.